Hi everyone. Okay, yeah, thank you for joining us now. So yeah, we have pretty much most of our panelists joined us already. Yeah, I'm invited you to be speakers. So to Emma and to Hazel, I will just send you the same invitation now, and you can accept that invitation. Yes, I can hear you perfectly. Thank you. That's worked well. So yeah, hello to our panelists, Nikolai, Nazan, to Osman Baydemir, you're welcome. And to the friends from the UK delegation. We're just going to give a couple of minutes for the speakers to get logged on. I think we're pretty much all there. And for the audience to fill up. We have a good number of listeners here already. You're all very welcome. We're going to start this discussion on the upcoming Turkish elections in a couple of minutes. And we're very happy to have our panelists joining us here today. I'm just going to invite Bedia to be a speaker as well. And then I think we have all of our panel logged on, which is good because the technology is working in our favor. So I'm just going to allow a couple more minutes. For more listeners and more audience members to join us at this Media News panel, looking at the upcoming Turkish elections and the Kurdish role as kingmakers at this epochal moment for democracy in Turkey. We're very happy to have all of our panelists with us here today. I will just maybe just first say a couple of words to introduce the space. And then we will begin hearing from our speakers. So, as I think all of you who are here today know, the Turkish elections are coming up in 4 days' time. The first round of voting will be on the 14th of May. And so the world's eyes have this week turned to Turkey and this really epochal moment. You know, we are really not speaking in hyperbole when we say once in a lifetime occasion in Turkey, once in a generation opportunity to see real political change, perhaps following 2 decades of rule by Erdogan, the incumbent president. But on the one hand, Turkey remains an authoritarian regime, as we will hear from some of our speakers tonight with first-hand knowledge of that regime. Turkey has long repressed dissent, particularly from the Kurdish minority, and all the more so under Erdogan, and all the more so in the past 5 years, particularly. And this election is really seeming like a turning point, a question of whether there can still be full expression within the democratic process within Turkey. I'm sure our panelists will say much more about the situation and what's happening on the ground. Perhaps just to give a little more overview before we begin, the elections will see the main opposition party in Turkey, the CHP, represented by Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, essentially go head to head for the presidency with the incumbent president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The Kurdish-led third largest opposition grouping, the People's Democratic Party, or HDP, is the principal force there, being represented in these elections by the Green Left Party, for reasons which we will come to in the course of this discussion, are not fielding their own presidential candidate and just kind of stepping aside at this moment with such pressure on the government, particularly following the deadly earthquake, which claimed 50,000 lives earlier this year, but also following many years of economic mismanagement, privatisation, corruption, and abuse of the rule of law and attacks on the civil society sector, they've chosen to essentially stand aside and allow Kılıçdaroğlu the best possible tilt at unseating Erdogan with their support. At the same time, the Kurdish-led progressive opposition, represented by the People's Democratic Party, or HDP, is fielding its own parliamentary candidates through the aforementioned Green Left Party in an effort to not only play the kingmaker role in these elections, but also to influence any future political settlement in Turkey. And this despite great repression of the HDP, which we're going to hear something about today. So I think that's enough by way of a preamble. I'm sure most people here are familiar with these essential points about what's happening. And now it's time to hand over to our speakers, who are going to go a bit more in depth on what role exactly the Kurdish-led opposition can play or should hope to play or should be enabled to play in the democratic process, whether a new political settlement is a possibility in Turkey, and how European institutions also can help us reach that end. So yeah, we will hear from our speakers one by one. We have a couple of questions for each of them, and we will then be also able to take some questions from the floor. We'll aim to get through all of our opening rounds of questions within the hour by 8 o'clock Central European time, and then have some time for some questions from the floor as well. So we appreciate all of our guests joining us here as well. I can see many friends and supporters have come to join us in the space today. So we're going to hear from a number of speakers. We're going to hear from Nikolay Willemsen, who's joining us from Europe, to give the perspective from the left group in the EU Parliament on the European institutions and what they can do in this situation. We're going to hear, on the other hand, from a British delegation currently on the ground to observe the elections in Turkish Kurdistan for some first-hand insight into what's happening there and the attacks on the Kurdish opposition. We're going to hear from Nazan Ustundag, a Kurdish sociologist, feminist and academic, to look at some of the more broader implications and ideological implications of what the Kurdish movement is trying to do in Turkey. And perhaps most importantly of all, and most excitingly of all, we're going to hear from two representatives of the People's Democratic Party. In a moment, we're going to hear from Bedir Özgürce, who is the elected HDP mayor of Van. But perhaps first we can invite a guest that we're very excited just to hear a few short words from at the start of this space. Osman Baydemir, who is the HDP mayor of Diyarbakir. So Osman, if you're able to open your microphone, perhaps you can share some words with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I believe you have some thoughts for us on the need for support for the HDP. Are you able to share those with us today?
Thank you so much, distinguished participants, and I would like to thank you all for coming here, and thank you for giving me this opportunity. To be honest, for me is going to be a little bit hard because I am not good at technology. Technology is absolutely make life easier, but not for people like me, the old generations. And thank you very much for this opportunity again. And the election on 40 May represents the biggest opportunity for political change Turkey has seen for a generation. The past two decades have seen Turkish President Erdogan rule with an increasingly authoritarian hand. Now here has this been more obvious than in his repeated attacks on the Kurdish people and their movement for democracy and fundamental rights, both at home and abroad. Domestically, Erdogan has launched sustained attacks on the progressive Kurdish-led opposition, and particularly my own People's Democratic Party, or HDP. 11 HDP MPs have been jailed. more than 20 mayors have been jailed and other leading HDP politicians like myself have been driven into exile. Thousands HDP activists now have been jailed. The HDP and the progressive pro-Kurdish opposition are going to play a kingmaker role in the upcoming elections, with our party choosing not to put forward a candidate to give the Turkish people the chance to unite in opposition to Erdogan. For Erdogan's policies and dictatorial approach have done great harm to the Turkish people as a whole. Despite contempts, arrests, repression and harassment, our activities and politicians are on the ground today in their thousands working to spread the news about the progressive federal alternative model of politics, which we know is the only answer to the main problems facing Turkey today. We call upon European governments, parliamentary institutions, and progressive parties to take action to ensure the democratic progress and rule of law are respected in this crucial elections. And to be honest, let me give the other two words about what is the Kurdish question in Turkey. One of the main problem is the fact that the Kurds do not have basic human rights in Turkey, and they are not recognized as a people by the Turkish state, apart some limited individual rights. And this is mainly because the Turkish state is based on an identity that was and is explicitly Turkish, which denied all other ethnicities, the Kurds in particular. Therefore, the Kurdish people demand status. The Kurds demand democracy. The Kurds demand justice and dignified peace. The election of 14 May, the result of elections, the door of heaven may not be open on the morning of May 15. But the door of hell will be closed on the morning of May 15. This will be the result of our policy. This is be the result of HDP policy. Thank you very much for listening to me. And thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Osman, and we really appreciate you joining us here now. We know you're, of course, very busy with your campaigning from where you are today. And that is what I actually want to ask Anne. Yeah, thank you. I would like to ask our next speaker to address. We're now going to be joined by Bedia Özgökçe, and much like Osman, Bedia is the democratically elected mayor of another one of Turkey's largest Kurdish majority cities in Van. But like Osman, then Bedia now lives in exile in Europe. So Bedia, perhaps to begin, you could just introduce and explain for our listeners why is it that you have been deposed from your democratically elected post as mayor? And how does this trustee regime work, and why is that important in these elections?
Now, okay. Thank you very much. I would like to greet all participants and good evening to you all. Yeah, first of all, I want to make a small correction. In the advertisement, you wrote under my name as a former mayor of Van, but I want to make it clear to have, I want to make a small correction. I am the current elected mayor. I was elected in 2019. This is a small thing, but it is very important. So I want to say a few words about this. As you know, the government doesn't recognize the result of elections in the Kurdish cities in any way and doesn't recognize the basic citizenship rights of the Kurdish people. This trusty regime is a special concept against Kurdish people's will, and both the mentality and the practice is totally a colonial mindset. It takes away the Kurdish people's right to participate in governance. This government is using all its powers through tyranny and de facto, without recognizing the constitution and the will of the people. For the decision to appoint a trustee, an investigation within the scope of the anti-terrorism law is enough. A law is enough, even if it is fabricated. As defined in the constitution, there is no any accusation related to the mayor's duty, nor does it wait for a court ruling that the accusation has been proven and judgment has been rendered. And this is used only and only for the Kurdish people and Kurdish elected mayors. For other parties, it was only used as a threat. In all aspects and clearly, the decision to appoint a trustee is a coup. In order to legitimize this coup, the government both creates a justification, speeds up the trials against us by instructing the courts, and creates a conceptual memory with perhaps inconspicuous interventions such as former mayor. It targets us everywhere. It makes anti-propaganda with arguments that do not exist in the cases against us. Therefore, it manages a multifaceted perception. If you remember, the appointment of a trustee in Istanbul was on the agenda because an investigation was opened against Ekrem İmamoğlu, because that time it was discussed in Turkey for İmamoğlu to be a candidate for this rally. At that time, the government-backed press, even Wikipedia, immediately used the term former mayor for İmamoğlu. Actually, all the opposition and also İmamoğlu immediately drew attention to this discourse. So it was also on the agenda and has been discussed in the country. The opposition made this issue visible and they prevented it for themselves. This government did the same thing for us many times. In order to legitimize the decision to appoint a trustee, a prosecutor opened an investigation against us, and the interior minister immediately suspended us from duty. We are being sued with hasty and fabricated files. This government is manipulating national and international public opinion by citing the anti-terrorism law with baseless accusations that are in no way related to the task. As the Kurdish people, we are also struggling against this manipulation and black propaganda. The opposition did not react to the appointment of trustees for two terms, knowing that very well it was unconstitutional. They chose to remain silent when it comes to us. To be honest, I think this was a choice for them. But now they make promises. They should be clear about the trustee policy. Do Kurds have the right to vote and be elected? Not at the moment. We all know that. But will it be guaranteed when the law is unconstitutional, the constitutional order breaks down? The damage it causes to the public and the damage it causes to society is much greater. Kılıçdaroğlu should be clear about this, and the opposition, of course. And he himself makes these promises. We will also wait and see, of course. Thank you for this opportunity for the first turn. I will answer your other questions in the next turn, maybe. Thank you.
Yes, yeah, thank you so much, Bedia. Yeah, we look forward to hearing from you again. If you like, you could also go on now. You've described a bit Yeah, some of the ways in which the Turkish authorities have attacked the democratic process and yourself and the Kurdish-led democratic opposition in Turkey. Perhaps maybe now you could share with us for a couple more minutes about the kind of support that you would like to see from Europe and from international actors to prevent these kind of abuses taking place in Turkey, if you have some thoughts on that, before we hear from Nikolay.
Okay. You ask about the EU institutions or the behavior of opposition, I suppose. As you know, the Kurdish people have fundamental rights, both historically and as a society, just like all peoples in the world. And the Kurdish people have paid and are paying a very heavy price in order to live these basic rights. If we look at the issue within the scope of the Kurdish problem and its solution, we can give correct answers. The Kurdish people never gave up their search for peace and its broadest form in order to achieve their basic rights. While Turkey describes itself as a state, it describes itself as a democratic republic. However, we all know that this situation doesn't reflect the truth. We know well that the Kurdish problem is managed with no solution, that the Turkish society has been consolidated with nationalism at all times, and that it has always been suppressed by massacres, torture, and arrests. We know well that every period is bloody. There is a regime in Turkey that has been ruled by coups at all times, has been framed with Turkish, Islamic, Sunni outlines, and excludes and oppresses anyone who doesn't accept this definition. The ability of the Kurds to elect representatives through elections has always been prevented and subjected to coups. Our elected deputies were arrested. Our deputies were killed in the past. Our mayors were either arrested, killed, or forced into exile. Our right to be represented in the parliament was blocked with the 10% threshold. Kurdish threshold until the 2015 elections. In the past, we only had the opportunity to be represented by independent candidates. If we look at all these as a whole, we can perhaps say that the democracy used by the state's regime is only defined democracy. The 2015 June 7 elections are a very important historical turning point in this sense. It is an election in which we have rendered the Kurdish threshold meaningless. Since then, our role as a kingmaker has become very strong. If you look at what happened after that date and the heavy pressure regime and practices against us, you will see that clearly the state has taken a new structuring decision regarding its plan for the Kurds. Regime change was made, and now the threshold has risen to 50%. With the fraudulent 2018 election, the repression regime turned to the entire opposition. In the 2019 local elections, 12 metropolitan cities were lost to the AKP with the HDP's, our party's strategy to regress the AKP. In that election, the kingmaker was the Kurds. And now, currently, the kingmaker is the Kurds. And both the ruling bloc and the opposition bloc know this reality very well. Within the great patience and persistence of the Kurdish people, despite all the costs we are paid, we are at the same point and demand our fundamental rights. Today, Turkish society also takes a stance in favor of change and democratization. Everyone sees the unmanageability of this presidential system. Fundamental elements such as the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary have been abolished. The opposition's offer and promise are in favor of a democratic change, saying that the problems will be solved by talking and unlawful practices will be ended. They say they will end the trust regime. They say that they will base the independence of the judiciary and the rule of law. And we say that we are against the dictatorship in this election. We say that the current regime must go. For this reason, we support the opposition, Kılıçdaroğlu. For this reason, we did not nominate a candidate. But we know that everything will not change in a day, of course. This is a process in which the struggle will continue for the Kurds after the election. The opposition has the opportunity to seriously determine a funding policy. It is possible to follow a peaceful policy away from the politics of tension. There's an urgent need for a process where the rule of law is superior and the trust in the justice mechanism is established, instead of a policy that creates tensions and turns people against each other. In such a situation, the opposition should evaluate the management mentality in favor of all peoples, and especially by making efforts to solve the Kurdish problem through a democratic way. This is our expectation, but we will continue to make an effort in this regard. Therefore, we emphasize that our representation in the parliament is very important for this election. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's very useful to hear, you know, about how, as we see so often, perhaps modes of oppression initially aimed at the Kurdish opposition then become more widely implemented across politics and across civil society in Europe, and also to hear some inside thoughts on the tactical and strategic decisions, the difficult decisions that the Kurdish-led opposition has had to take at this moment. We look forward to hearing from you again later in the evening. Of course, as I mentioned, there will be an opportunity for guests to put some questions as we come to the end of the last 20 minutes or so of this panel. If you're worried you're going to forget your question, do feel free to tweet it at us at @medianews_. And I will keep an eye on that and invite you to put it. And we will also have the chance for some people to speak and share their questions after the hour. But now I would like to go on to hear from our next guest. We're very happy to be joined today by Nikolai Willumsen from the Left Group in the European Parliament, who has long raised his voice in Europe and in European institutions in defence of the progressive opposition and shared values of democracy and the Kurdish cause in Turkey. Nikolai, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
To begin with, you could speak to us, you know, in these kind of crucial few days before the election, what steps, and perhaps in the weeks after the election, depending on what happens, indeed, what steps could or should EU parliaments and institutions be taking to ensure that the democratic process is being respected in Turkey?
Thank you, Matt. And it's a great honor to be here. And as you rightly say, this is a crucial election. And I think we cannot underestimate how historic events will be Sunday. Actually, no matter the result and the outcome, even though we, of course, all hope for a brighter future for the people of Turkey after a dark time with Erdogan. I think you're very right. There is a before and there is an after Sunday. And if I will start by talking about the before Sunday. And here, of course, it's crucial to speak out against the crackdown going on in Turkey right now. What we have been seeing throughout many years is, of course, the imprisonment of the political opposition, the crackdown on trade unions, not least very hard oppression of the Kurdish people, and of course this is totally unacceptable. But also in recent days we have seen attacks on the opposition, and this is of course totally unacceptable. And I do my best to speak out against this. Other good people do the same. There's no doubt that that I wish that the voice of the European Union was stronger as we speak right now in these days. But I think it's also important to point out that there has been a long-standing criticism coming from different European institutions towards the oppression of Erdogan, even though I could wish it had been stronger. And I think something that is important when we speak about oppression going on in Turkey is that this is not the question of democracy and human rights in Turkey is not just something one could wish for. It's important to be aware that Turkey is a member of the Council of Europe. Turkey has signed the European Human Rights Convention, and Erdogan is thereby obliged to secure the people of Turkey their human rights. And of course, a country can decide to leave the Council of Europe, can decide to skip the Human Rights Convention. We have seen that Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, has done that. But Erdogan has not done this. And as long as Turkey is a member of the Council of Europe, the Turkish government and president is obliged to secure the human rights of its people and follow the decisions of the Human Rights Court, which has filed several strong verdicts against the oppression going on in Turkey. One, as an example, to demand the immediate release of Selahattin Demirtas, the former chair and presidential candidate of the HDP. So this is not something we could wish Erdogan to secure the human rights of the people of Turkey. This is an obligation Erdogan has, and I think that's important also speaking about the urgency and the importance of Europe and all European institutions speaking out clearly against what's going on with oppression in Turkey. I think it's also important to be aware that we see that Erdogan is desperate, and we do not only see that with the crackdown internally in Turkey. We also have seen this with the international observers. There's been a situation where the Turkish authorities has denied members of the international election observation from the OSCE to enter the country. This is one of my countrymen, Søren Sondergaard, member of the Danish parliament, has received a letter from the Turkish authorities denying him the right to be part of the election observation. There is a Swedish social democratic member of Swedish parliament that has received the same denial from the Turkish authorities. And I think this is, of course, also something that should be criticized extremely clear by European institutions. We cannot have a situation where the acting president, the acting government are allowed to pick and choose who will observe an election or not. This is fundamental in doing elections observations. So I think this shows how desperate Erdogan is, and this also shows how bad the situation of democratic rights and how concerned we should be about the possibility and the right of the people of Turkey to have a free and fair election Sunday. Then speaking about, Matt, if I may, also the after Sunday, and I think that's also important. We all have a great hope that the people of Turkey will be allowed to decide their future, that there will not be cheating and fraud going on, but that they are free to decide their future, and of course also decide not to have Erdogan as president. And in this situation, I think it's important to be aware that then we have a totally new situation of relationship between Europe and Turkey. It's no secret that the relationship between Europe and Turkey has been frozen for many years, and we are at a crossroad. If Erdogan do not win, if there is a change in Turkish politics, then there is a possibility for a revival of EU-Turkey relationship. And I think here, as also has been rightly pointed out, the Green Left Party can play a crucial role. It seems they will be kingmakers, and there's no doubt that if there is to be a revival of EU-Turkey relationship and a fruitful and better relationship between EU and Turkey, it will require that the Green Left Party have their demands for a more democratic more free and just and peaceful Turkey met in a new parliament. So I will start here, and please do put more questions if needs be, Matt.
Thank you. Yes, we appreciate that, Nikolai. And please, everyone, feel free to send in your own questions by tweeting at us at the Medianews _. I can see we've received a couple of questions already. And please do also feel free to share this event with your own followers and invite them to join this discussion that we're having today. We'll come back to you again, perhaps, Nikolai, in a few moments before you leave us for some further thoughts from yourself. But now I want to turn to something that you mentioned yourself. There is an attempt by the Turkish government to control who can observe, who can follow, who can monitor these elections on the ground. To counter that, the People's Democratic Party, the HDP, has invited electoral delegations from across the globe to travel to Turkey and to observe on the ground the work that they're doing in communities there, and also, of course, the repression of the democratic process, and particularly of the Kurdish-led opposition there, by the police and other institutions. So I'm going to invite now two members of a British delegation that are currently on the ground in Bakur, or Turkish Kurdistan, Emma Muller and Hazel Erish. If you would like to join us now, perhaps you can share just your general observations from the, I think, week or 2 weeks that you've spent working there following the electoral process, and particularly any insights on the way that the democratic process is being repressed.
Hello, thank you very much for inviting us to this call. I'm Emma Miller, and as you already mentioned, I'm part of the delegation from the UK to Bakur. We're currently based in Ahmet, so Diyarbakir in Turkish, and we are a delegation of lawyers, local activists, and academics who will stay here for a total of 3.5 to 4 weeks. And we have been here for 2 weeks following the pre-election mobilization by the Yeşil Sol Party. To maybe start with some general observations, what has really stood out to us is the joy and fire of resistance that exists everywhere here in Ahmet and the surrounding villages that we have been visiting. For me personally, what stands out the most are all the children that have been massively greeting us with waving flags, dancing, chanting, really having their eyes full of joy and hope for change coming with these elections. But it doesn't stop with the children, especially villages that vote majority for Yeşil Sol or have voted majority for HDP in the past. Normally there's dancers breaking out as soon as we enter with the campaign van, with the cars so full of stickers and playing the campaign songs. And people are very, very grateful for us, as well as the supporters of the party and the candidates for the party, to take the time to go and speak to every village in the area of Ahmet. So the Yeşil Sol Party has made a promise that they are visiting every village and every town district before the elections to speak to people, to see what do you need from us, what do you need in these from the party if we get elected, and how, what are your struggles right now. And this is a second observation that's to us very different than how we have observed politics to happen in the UK, is this closeness to the people here. So the candidates have taken extensive time to speak to every person they've been meeting, to us as well, explaining what's going on, explaining what they stand for. One of the candidates actually has an 11-month-old baby, and I do not know how she has the energy and motivation to go out every day from 8 a.m. until 11 p.m., feeding her baby in the middle somehow. And you can really see that the candidates are burning for change and are putting their heart in the struggle. Also, the part that Hazel will go into later, knowing that repression is very likely to follow if Erdogan stays president. Besides visiting villages, we've also joined the campaign visiting factories or local industrial parks. And again, speaking to the workers, one quote that was translated to us after the question of what can we do for you was a young worker saying, what you can do for us is winning these elections and changing our conditions. And this was a worker who, again, Hazel will talk about this later in a second, is not allowed to work as a teacher because of his political activities as well as his Kurdish identity. Besides these visits over the day, in the evenings, there's often parties in front of the Yeşilsol offices, including the whole neighborhood, dancing Kurdish dances, mostly joined by local Kurdish or other ethnic minorities, singers. The vibe is always very, very vibrant, very joyful, even though it's normally joined by at least 100 police officers, water cannons, and further tools of repression. And then my last observation is that the Yeşilsol party, of course, has a lot of answers to the Kurdish question, as the previous speakers have pointed out. But I also wanted to share that the party is pushing for change in a lot of different levels, both within the local districts, as well as on the wider. The party has an incredibly in-depth agenda, for example, pushing for rights for LGBTQ people, animal rights, as well as youth organization and the right for youth to be more involved in politics. I joined a youth meeting this afternoon, for example, where the candidate took extensive time to discuss with this youth group what he should be bringing into parliament with them and for them. So yes, on really every level, the Yeşilsol party is standing for a multicultural and multicolored Turkey and pushing for this change, even in conservative villages. Now I'm going to hand over to Hazel, who will talk a bit more about repression as well as her general observations.
Cool. Thank you for having us. I really appreciate this. And yeah, it's hard to know exactly where to begin because we've had such busy programs for the few weeks that we've been here, usually leaving in the morning and then coming back in the evening. And every day there's a kind of like street party actually in the city where people go out and they dance to traditional music and like make speeches. So in particular, in terms of repression, I wanted to start by thinking back to the day after I arrived here, where more than 120 people were imprisoned. Most of them were actively supporting Yeşilsol Party's campaign. Most of them were academics and also lawyers, journalists, actually a lot of artists as well. And a lot of them were detained and then further remanded. And this was all in dawn raids. A lot of people have already obviously experienced this type of repression a lot of times before. But this is just one of the continuous types of assaults on the party and also actually on the society and the people. This happens all of the time in the following days and the following weeks. There's been more raids and more arrests, not quite to the same degree. But every time I've been here, also two times in the past, mostly staying in Ahmed. And when I was here a year ago, there was also continuously raids and arrests, especially for HDP members and especially people who were working in democratic structures, for example, like the now criminalized DTK and other like Rosa Women's Association and other civil society organizations that try to meet the needs of people that are particularly run by Kurdish people and anyone on the left actually as well. And then, so the same day that all these arrests were made, in the middle of Ahmed, there was a speech, like a denouncement of the arrests by Yeşilsol Party. And the police obviously knew that this was going to happen. So they had literally hundreds of police kettling people, like surrounding the announcement, surrounded. They had like the riot shields and this kind of public order equipment, surrounded then by much larger public order equipment, like the mentioned water cannons. And also military is like never really far off as well. There's like several military bases in the middle of the city. And it was a constant process of being separated from each other, the police kettling us, marching for about 3 meters, being separated again, And at the front of this, there were really, really very powerful mothers from the movement who were saying, rise up against tyranny, rise up against the oppression. And yeah, for hours it went on like this. And this is not at all a uncommon way of dealing with that the state tries to deal with the movement. Also, I think there's so many layers actually to the repression, because the struggle for freedom exists on so many levels itself. So for example, like last year when I was here, but also now, every single day there's military planes going overhead from this nearby military base that's just outside of Ahmed, mostly flying towards Bashur and towards the mountains in between the areas of Kurdistan to bomb those areas. And this is like a very, very frequent sound. So there's this like kind of constant military presence. Today we went to Lije, a few of us went there, and it's like quite a heavily militarized zone. And it has been actually for decades. So a lot of the places where the villages around Lije were burned, military bases were then set up, and they still are active now. And actually there was an active military like excursion in the mountains around Lije today, which actually we didn't see, but also some of the people in the town were talking about, and we saw it in the news, because they're trying to find and kill any guerrillas that live in the mountains. And at the same time, like, the population is massively surveilled. So people generally feel extremely, extremely under pressure. And when I was here a year ago, I would say that one thing that has changed in terms of the atmosphere between then and now, traveling through a lot of these same areas, is that like, people feel under extreme pressure to say any words such as Kurdistan, APO, like this kind of thing. And now I have to say, like, there is much more, I think people feel like now is really a time that it's possible to come together and to actually say what they feel, which has not been easy to do for years, maybe decades. But it's like a really beautiful thing to see this expression through language, through like slogans, through really just like people in the street. If we're handing out flyers, car drivers will say it. Today in Lije, a mother, like, we were walking through the market, and one of the mothers saw the candidate and just ran over, kissed his face, you know, was like so happy to see him and was really like wishing for the victory of the party. And there's so many ways to also see like how the grief that people have felt for decades here is also like this continuous form of repression that the state utilizes against people. Because also a lot of the mothers here, they feel represented by the party, but also it's their children, whether that's in the 90s or whether that's 5 years ago or now, who are being killed by the state or imprisoned by the state. And as some of the other speakers already mentioned, actually the prison struggle and the constant incarceration of people and of society is one of the main ways that Yeshil Sol Party, but also really all layers of society and the struggle, is trying to be contained by the prison system. And yeah, this is, I think, like, also a very, very powerful form of struggle. Like, many people that I've met have said, I said, oh, you know, very academic Kurdish. And they say, yeah, I learned it in prison. This is also like not a way that people will be stopped, but it is, of course, a way that the state tries to impede people in the quest for freedom. And then also, yeah, I'll just say like briefly that one of the, like, similar, I guess, to the effects of the village burnings and the also earthquake in the 90s, and this like forced demographic replacement that happened then as a way to fracture society and the struggle as this form of repression. Also now we see this where, like, since the earthquake, thousands and thousands of, well, millions of people had to leave, and the majority of them have not been able to actually re-register where they can vote again. So this form of like silencing of the right to vote, and also of this forced demographic replacement that the state also wants to implement in those areas which have already suffered extreme assimilation policies for decades, this is like another continuing form of repression. Everything now is a continuation of the past forms of repression.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Hazel, for sharing those observations from the ground. We would like to hear again, I think, from Nikolai before he leaves us at 8 o'clock. But first, I would really like to welcome our final panelist, Nazan Ustundag, a very well-known Kurdish sociologist, Kurdish academic and feminist. Nazan, perhaps I can just simply ask you to speak for a few minutes and tell us what will and won't change for women in Turkey if the government changes. What's the impact going to be on women and their situation?
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I would like to first correct you. I'm not Kurdish. Although I study Kurdish politics, and I regard myself to be part of the Kurdish movement. I'm not ethnically Kurdish, so I just want to correct that so that there is no misunderstanding. So I would like to say first a few words on why previous speakers have already mentioned that it is the importance of Yeşil Sol Party to be in the parliament. I just want to make sure that this is understood really well, because the alliance that, Kılıçdaroğlu's alliance is not necessarily an alliance that we trust. Although Kılıçdaroğlu we support, because we believe that Erdoğan needs to go, the alliance that he is part of is not necessarily an alliance that represents democracy. Meral Akşener, for example, or Davutoğlu, all of these people have been actually cooperating and co-opting with various massacres that occurs against Kurds and various violations of rights. So the reason why and that's why it is so important for Yeşil Sol Parti to be in the parliament, to actually push Kılıçdaroğlu towards a leftist politics, the previous speakers have talked about. It is not only about Kurdish rights. Of course, Kurdish rights, the push to peace, the push to autonomy is very, very important. But also for workers' rights, for ecological rights, for children's rights. It is very important that Yeşil Sol Parti is in the parliament so that it can push Kılıçdaroğlu towards the leftist politics. And otherwise, Kılıçdaroğlu's alliances are not necessarily democratic forces. When it comes to women's rights, actually, women in Turkey have been very active in the last decade, both in protesting Erdoğan's policies and coming together and forming alliances, committees, commissions, foundations, associations, and coalitions in order to prepare a collective list of their demands from the new government. And Eşik, for example, is one of the very important actors here, which is a coalition of different women's organizations and LGBT organizations. And two demands stand out. One of them is, as you know, Turkey or Erdoğan has basically undemocratically and unconstitutionally declared that Turkey is not going to be part of the Istanbul contract, which is a contract that secures an effective fight against violence against women. And another thing Erdoğan did was by the excuse of the attempted coup, he closed all women's organizations in Bakur, Turkish Kurdistan, and also have imprisoned many of the women's representatives of HDP and women leaders and women activists and women politicians. So one of the things that we expect as women from this new government and the new Kılıçdaroğlu is, first of all, the release of all women political prisoners. Women political prisoners have been accused for participating. I mean, the accusations that are brought against them are ridiculous, and many of the accusations concern their participation in the women's movement. So release of women prisoners, is women political prisoners, is a primary issue that is on the table, and that women's coalition have brought to the attention of all political parties running for parliamentary representation. A second thing is, of course, reassuming of the fight against violence against women, because since AKP's rule, women being killed by their husbands, by their fathers, and so on, has increased exponentially. That is due to the, of course, patriarchal nature of the state and patriarchal nature of the government. And Yeşil Sol Party has been a really great ally of women in that fight. And we are expecting from the new government the resumption of this fight, going back to the Istanbul Convention. And of course, the reopening of all women's organizations that have been closed. And the last but not the least important issue is LGBTI rights. LGBTs have never been spoken so much about in Turkey until this election. Erdogan and his allies have actually, next to the Kurds, made the object of hatred in this elections LGBTI people, and have announced their hostility to LGBTI people. So a third, last but not least, what we expect from this government is the insurance that LGBTI rights will be respected and will be recognized both constitutionally and practically. Let me finish here, since I see that we are running out of time, and if other questions come, I can answer them in due time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Nazan. Thank you for correcting me on the Kurdish question as well. And we appreciate that. The Istanbul Convention. The European Parliament, where Nikolai is working. So that maybe brings us to our final question for Nikolai today, and we will have time, for the next half hour to put some questions to the other panelists. But Nikolai, perhaps you could just share with us, we've talked a lot about the internal situation in Turkey today. Why are these elections important for Europe? What will their impact be on Europe as a whole, not just within Turkey?
I think they will be huge, no matter what happened. Of course, I think that it's clear that for the people of Turkey, these elections are crucial and historic, but for Europe, they are also crucial. What relationship will Europe have with Turkey in the future? And of course, it's clear if Erdogan grabs power again and continue oppression, the frozen relationship, the conflict between Europe and Turkey will grow. If the opposition, the democratic opposition, win, if the Green Left Party gets a kingmaker position and are able to change Turkish politics in a more democratic, just and peaceful way, I think that there are great opportunities for a fruitful relationship between Europe and Turkey. So I think there's also for Europe a lot to gain from a democratic change in Turkey. So that's really, I think, an interest we all have. And I think if you just allow me, Matt, I'll just say something that I've really striking me for the many years I have followed the situation in Turkey. And I think it's very well described by the people on the ground also today, that there are so many terrible news coming from Turkey, and it has been this situation for such a long time. But what has always amazed me is the spirit of the people, not least the Kurds, has also been described from the streets of Ahmet or Diyarbakir, if you will. And I think this is an inspiration for me, and I think for many people in Europe. And it gives hope for the future, gives hope to win Sunday, but also hope that Turkey's politics can change in a better way, in a more democratic, just and peaceful way. So I'm very sorry, I will have to leave you because there's a plenary going on here in Strasbourg in the European Parliament. But I would say my final words would be that of course, thank you for allowing me to be with you. And I think it's clear that there is a hope in Europe for a better future for the people of Turkey. There's a hope clearly in the streets in Turkey and the Kurdish areas, not least. But no matter what happens Sunday, you can be sure that I will do my utmost, and the left group here in the European Parliament, together with many good friends, will do our utmost to support the democratic opposition, no matter the result Sunday. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much, Nikolai. Yeah, we really appreciate it. We thank you for joining us here today. So Nikolai has to leave us now, but we have about 20 minutes, half an hour remaining of our panel, and we have some more questions for the panelists. People, please do feel free to send in your own questions. If you would like to speak and put your question, you can also send us a request to speak, or you can simply tweet your questions at us at @MedjaNews_. I have a question from Mark Campbell, a journalist, a well-known journalist and activist in the Kurdish movement, which I would like to put to Bedia. Mark asks, Kılıçdaroğlu says that if he wins the election, he will try and find a solution to the Kurdish question in the Turkish parliament. Can we trust Kılıçdaroğlu to find a solution to the Kurdish question? Or if not, how can we pursue a peaceful political solution to the Kurdish question in Turkey? Bedia, maybe you have some thoughts about that. Hi, Bedia. I'm wondering if you can hear me. But if not, then perhaps we can wait a minute to see if we can hear from you. But perhaps, yeah, we could also hear some thoughts from Nazan as well, or one of the other panelists. Do we think that Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu's promise to pursue a solution to the Kurdish question in the parliament can be trusted? And if not, how can we reach a solution to this question in Turkey?
Well, I can say just a few words on that, which will be actually a continuation of what I said earlier. I think it depends on the representation of Yeşil Sol Party in the parliament. Because people's insistence on the solution of the Kurdish question, there is no guarantee that Kılıçdaroğlu will, there is no guarantee whatsoever that Kılıçdaroğlu will keep his promise as long as there is no pressure from the civil society, from women, and from Yeşil Sol Party in the parliament. That's what I can say.
Yeah, thank you so much. Perhaps we will be able to hear Bedia to give some thoughts from that, from the perspective of the HDP in a moment. In the meantime, we can go back to put another question to the British parliamentary delegation who are working there on the ground in Kurdish regions of Turkey. We asked you earlier, Emma and Hazel, to speak about the sort of particularly the extent of police repression on this process. But perhaps you could also say something about the diversity of ways in which the HDP and the Kurdish movement in general are working to counter this state repression and to spread democratic values in Turkey. Do you have some more thoughts you can share about that?
Yeah, so we can both add something on this. In terms of the diversity of ways that the movement is resisting this, again, I think that this is really a continuation of the forms of resistance that HDP, Yeşil Sol Party, and also the wider struggle has already learned, because the prison struggle is nothing new, and also the military attacks and the assimilation policies are nothing new. So I think that in terms of, I think like finding ways to resist in even like the hardest conditions actually is the first thing that comes to mind. So for example, in the prisons, like this being a site of resistance and of like communal organization, that the civil society organizations on the outside are connected in some way. And I think, for example, seeing Yeşil Sol Party members going and very often visiting the Saturday mothers or like the families of people who've had their children killed by the state or imprisoned by the state, this is one of the ways that actually building that, it's not just like solidarity in like this transactional sense, actually it's something that's like a very deep form of I think like building a form of social living together, because also a lot of the people throughout these organizations are linked in across many different ways. So there's like, yes, there is like the kind of straightforward party work of like visiting the shops, having chai with people, making flyers, talking about how to vote and stuff like that. But also it's like paying respects to the dead. It's also really like knowing how are people's families doing, and also like really trying to know like what is it that people need. And I think in terms of like also just briefly, like it's kind of linked to this previous question as well. I think that if the opposition, if Cehebe does win, like I don't think anyone here is really saying, oh, then everything will just be resolved and this will be such a, this will just like make everything easy and possible in terms of like living freely and having some like basic rights. But it's just about trying to like shift the kind of current forms of power structures. And yeah, in terms of how like Yeşil Sol has a diversity of expression and tactics, I think that how people interact with children, how people are across the, not fabricla, the, what's the word, factories, and also like in villages, like whether this is in the middle of the city or in the middle of the village, like regardless of also like social class, I've really seen so many people for many different reasons that are very complex have an attachment to the party. Like even people in the same family who might vote for different parties or who might have actually different politics, I think trying to organize through that complexity and not having these like very rigid hard boundaries of politics, but really trying to like engage with contradictions and really trying to engage with like difficulty is something that I've seen a lot here that I really respect and learned from. And I'm going to pass over to Emma as well.
Yeah, so I want to start with the stories of you, like I think a week ago now, the event of one of the evening parties. And by the time we got there, everyone was dancing and laughing. I was in one of the poorest areas of Ahmet, and I would reckon there were around 100-150 people there. And one of the candidates told me that earlier that evening, the party got almost cancelled because one man from the youth wing of the parliamentary party was arrested, and then everyone stormed into the arrest. And they actually really feared that the cops would come and crack down on this party massively. But then another person just started playing music and started dancing, and everyone joined in. And this is like one of the really powerful forms of resistance that we've been seeing, is even like literally dancing and shouting the slogans of the Yeşil Sol Party and Freedom for Demirtaş right next, like in the face of the police officers next to them, as if the police officers wouldn't stand there, as if the police officers wouldn't even often outnumber the people dancing, having like massive military vehicles just around the corner, ready to crack down on the party. Every police officer not just wearing like a small pistol, but actually like a big rifle. And people just ignoring all of this in order to dance dances of their culture in order to show that they will resist no matter the cost. And just, yeah, in an extremely beautiful way, and not in a way that's just, oh yeah, we need to laugh and then we go home and we're sad, but in a way that actually is so full of hope and joy that this could never be faked. And similarly, I want to share an experience, the experiences of the 1st of May, where we joined the Yeshu Soul block on the 1st of May, but it was never separated by blocks, the demonstration. We were all kettled together. We were all helping each other, sharing our experiences, sharing how politics are going around us right now. And politics is not defined as only the things that are happening by elected people. It's defined as everything that happens around us, because everything is inherently political. When people were hugging each other, hadn't seen each other for some time, sharing how the works are going in the teachers' union, in the doctors' union, in the Yeshu Soul party, HDP politicians were sharing about their experiences. People who've been banned from politics because they were replaced by trustees or imprisoned before. Everyone just coming together. And this resistance is super strong across society, and there's no division between the politicians of the party and other members of society or people of civil organizations. And another point to add, and this is my last point, is the resistance of the youth that we can see very strongly around us. The youth is massively affected by assimilation politics. In fact, loads of young people we've met don't speak Kurdish anymore. They have only grown up with Turkish. And yet we see young people every day on the streets handing out leaflets for Yeshu Soul, organizing meetings. Tomorrow there will be an afternoon rally for young people in Ahmet, for example, very regularly, and constantly fueling the resistance, even though they know that they have been, that assimilation has been inflicted so much on them, and they could just choose the easy part of speaking Turkish fluently, actually having grown up with Turkish as their mother tongue, which was a very different situation in the 80s and 90s in Bakur, for people growing up there. And they could just join the identity of being Turkish and make a normal life. And yet they still, because they're Kurdish, because they have seen this repression around them, but also because they have a hope that one day they can learn their languages again and they can be themselves fully, will continue this resistance, and this as an active choice, especially in the youth. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I think, yeah, we are now joined again by Bedia from the HDP, who is just going to say a few more words following on from some things Nicola was saying. Bedia, yeah, we wanted to ask you, what types of support would you like to see European institutions take to support the democratic process and the rule of law in Turkey in the weeks around the election?
Very sorry for the previous question. I couldn't ask. I missed it because there was a problem on my phone. But the expectations from EU institutions, yeah, I want to say that this election is not only affects Turkey very closely, but also closely concerns and affects European institutions and European countries, the communities. When Erdogan came to power, he promised to make Turkey a full member of the European Union. He promised to solve the Kurdish problem in democratic ways. He promised democracy. Briefly, he promised many things. Although he initially followed this policy for a while, but later he gave up. And as a candidate of the country, it has moved away from all democratic values. The Erdogan regime destroyed even the crumbs of democracy that existed, including the obligation to comply with international conventions. At the point we have reached today, Turkey's recent lawlessness and non-obligation have disrupted international relations. Yes, this is true, but the attitude and approach of the EU institutions in the face of this policy has also caused us to question the institutional value and importance of EU structures, because today EU institutions have turned into a situation shaped by Erdogan's threats. For example, on behalf of Turkey and as the president, Erdogan both do not implement the European Court of Human Rights decision and say he will not implement it openly without worries. And in the face of this attitude, EU institutions are even afraid to impose institutional attitudes and sanctions. It pursues a policy of negotiating refugees and threatening the whole of Europe, but Europe boasts to this threat. This view has even destroyed the very existence of the EU institutions. It is important for all EU institutions to follow these elections carefully in terms of universal values. EU institutions should no longer cause their own reason for existence to be debated. It should no longer intimidate and ignore the sacrifice of universal values to these threats. EU institutions should stop saying we are very concerned against the threat of refugees, the threat of war, when coups happened again and again against Kurds. We call EU institutions, please don't be so concerned. Take action immediately. It is time to take action because it should take the most comprehensive precaution against possible fraud in this election. Bad politics, war politics, don't know the borders. Rising walls cannot prevent the spread of evil. Countries that do not want refugees should not allow the policies of countries that produce refugees. Currently, Turkey is a refugee-producing country, and unfortunately, it has come to this point as a result of the EU Constitution's approach that encouraged Erdogan. We always warned, it is always what we said. Today, I want to draw the same attention again. We call on EU institutions to defend their values more today. For example, if Turkey doesn't implement the European Court of Human Rights decision, then both the court and the EU institutions should react very harshly to this approach, which casts a shadow on the human rights court's prestige. If there is no democracy in a country that is a member of the Council of Europe, if human rights are severely violated, then these institutions should do what is necessary. This is for the benefit of the whole society of European countries as well. Declaring war against the Kurdish people, forcibly removing them from their homeland where they lived for centuries, dropping bombs with warplanes, targeting civilians and children is to drag the Middle East into more chaos and war. It's a crime against humanity. We all know that. Not taking a stand against all these war crimes and not reacting even with a protest, when it comes to the Kurds especially, will only lead to more wars and migration. War is a disaster. European countries know this better, of course. Why are the European and world powers who came together with the basic motto, never again, are silent today? Of course, a Middle East at war will create a shock in Europe from every angle. As a matter of fact, Europe is in the throes of this today. Encouraging dictators means war, means chaos. We say that there is an opportunity for peaceful policies, and we make the same call to everyone. We must stop this regime. We must stop it together. I can say that this on this part.
Thank you very much, Bedia. And yeah, we really appreciate you joining us today in the middle of this electoral season and sharing your thoughts both on the situation within Turkey and within what steps can be taken outside more practically to reach a solution. We are coming to the end of our time together today. We just have time to put one more question to Nazan. We're getting quite a few written questions which are essentially repeating the same theme of can the Kurdish people really trust Kılıçdaroğlu and the CHP to find a solution for them? I think we've sort of covered that quite a lot, so perhaps we can just turn the question on its head a bit and ask, like, beyond the election and beyond the HDP's potential ability to play a kingmaker role, what positive contribution can the Kurdish political movement's analysis make in Turkey? What can they bring that's missing currently in Turkish political discourse?
Thank you. Most importantly, I think at this point, especially after the earthquake, we have seen the tragedy of the earthquake was partially caused by the fact that the regions in the earthquake were not administratively strengthened. On the contrary, everything is so centralized, it was impossible without Erdogan's words, Erdogan's orders, to even mobilize the army or mobilize the people, the rescue teams on the ground, because Turkey is so centralized right now. I think Yeşil Sol Party and HDP, most importantly, and the Kurdish movement in general, the idea of democratic autonomy that is promoted by the Kurdish movement is especially important for Turkey, which is a big country and which has so much ethnic multiplicity, and especially for the Kurdish region, needs an autonomous regional government, an autonomous, and by that I'm not meaning like a different nation state or anything, but the strengthening of the local administrations. Even the experience of municipalities like Diyarbakir municipality, which has been, and Diyarbakir civil society, rushing towards all the cities that have been affected by the earthquake, have shown how important it is to have these regional centers that can act by themselves and make decisions by themselves and apply those decisions by themselves in times of disaster, in times of crisis, and so on. So that's the first thing I would say. But of course, women's issues is the second thing. The Kurdish movement defines itself as a women's movement as much as an ethnic movement. And we have seen the importance in the, and the effect of this in the region, how women have been empowered and liberated by the Kurdish movement's ideology. And this has also empowered the Turkish women's movement and women's movements in the Middle East in general. So the second thing is that, and the third thing is, of course, ecology. The Kurdish movement's emphasis on ecology, war has destroyed, and the Turkish state has targeted Kurdish regions to ecologically ruin them. And this has developed a really important ecological consciousness in the Kurdish movement. And the Kurdish movement has been very active in ecological issues too. And this has also affected whole Turkey and empowered other ecological movements in the region. So I think these three, democratic autonomy, women's movement, and ecological consciousness, these have imprinted themselves now on the space of Turkey, and Kurds have been the architects of this, but have influenced so many different groups that now we can talk about a women's coalition, ecological coalition, and a coalition for regional autonomy in the entire Turkey.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think it's good to finish on this note and looking beyond, you know, of course, now all eyes are on the 14th of May and then what will or won't change then and possibly in the second round of elections, but to end with a wider look at what will be needed as Turkey potentially moves towards a more productive and democratic political settlement with equal rights for all its citizens, I think is worth closing on. So, yeah, I really just want to thank, of course, all of our panelists for speaking today. We heard from both Bedia and from Osman Baydemir from the People's Democratic Party and the progressive Kurdish-led opposition in Turkey, and it was great to have their perspectives. Good also to hear from Nikolai Willemsen and from Nazan, who was speaking just now, who in different ways are working to support and work alongside and understand that movement and both defend and protect it and allow its voice to be heard and call in different ways for the democratic process to be respected and strengthened in Turkey. So thanks to them as well. Thanks also to the members of the British observation delegation currently on the ground there in Turkish Kurdistan, seeing with their own eyes as they've shared with us so insightfully today what is actually happening day to day in these villages, in these neighbourhoods that we are speaking about in this panel. And thanks, of course, to all of you, to the audience, for joining us today and, yeah, following this really crucial moment, as we've heard, not only for Turkey, but for Europe, for the Middle East, and for, yeah, the very broad political process, which is coming to one culmination this Sunday. So, of course, we hope you will keep following the news here on Media News at our account, medianews_. We really do appreciate all of our speakers' time today. So thank you very much. And until the next broadcast, I've been Matt Broomfield. Good evening. Thank you.